This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. In the early years of the AIDS epidemic, when the disease didn't have a name and no one knew what caused it or how it was spread, my guests, Dr. Paul Volberding and Nurse Cliff Morrison, were taking care of people who were infected, very sick, and dying. Now they're featured in a new documentary titled 5B, about Ward 5B, the first inpatient special care hospital unit for treating people with AIDS. The unit opened in San Francisco General Hospital in 1983, the year that HIV was identified as the cause of AIDS. It became a model for AIDS treatment in the U.S. as well as other countries. Nurse Cliff Morrison created and then oversaw Ward 5B, where he insisted on emphasizing compassionate care, trying to address patients' emotional as well as medical needs. He became assistant director of nursing at the hospital. Dr. Paul Volberding was a doctor on the unit and went on to co-create an AIDS clinic at the hospital, which was one of the first such clinics in the country. He became well known for his work treating patients, as well as for his research into retroviruses like HIV, and for the development of drugs to treat the virus. The film 5B is playing in select theaters and will later be available on demand and streaming. Dr. Paul Volberding, Cliff Morrison, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for coming. The documentary is terrific, and thank you for all the work you've done over the years. I want to start at the beginning of the AIDS story for you. Can you each describe to us the first AIDS patient that you treated before AIDS or HIV was identified?
I started working at San Francisco General Hospital as a faculty member on July 1st, 1981, and I was seeing the patients in the hospital that had cancer, and I saw my first AIDS patient, a 22-year-old man with Kaposi's sarcoma, a striking case well before AIDS was the term was coined.
Kaposi's sarcoma is very rare. It wasn't rare for people with AIDS, but before AIDS, it was very rare. You get purple lesions over your body. Did you know what you were treating, and did you have any idea what was causing this cancer?
Quick answer is I didn't have a clue. I had just finished my training in cancer medicine, oncology, and I decided not to bother studying that tumor for my board exams because it was so rare. In the U.S., it was really never seen by oncologists. It was a disease occasionally seen in very elderly Jewish men, and it was almost a benign condition. So seeing it in a 22-year-old and seeing how sick he was unheard of.
The point is made in the documentary that early in the AIDS epidemic, people were afraid to go into the rooms of people with AIDS, and that even breakfast trays would pile up because everybody was afraid to go in and just like deliver the meal. Cliff, what were some of the other problems in treating and giving AIDS patients good, compassionate care, problems that led to the creation of 5B?
Staff were refusing to provide services or care to patients, not only nurses, but I think the auxiliary staff, the support staff. And I would go in patients' rooms, and you could tell that they hadn't had a bath. They weren't being taken care of. Their beds were dirty. Oftentimes, they were soiled. And in many situations, they were just too sick to even kind of respond to it. The ones who were completely humiliated. And, you know, as a nurse, I was appalled by what I was seeing. And like Paul, in my experience and already what I'd been seeing and what I was hearing from the specialists around us with the information that was coming out was that I wasn't at risk providing care to people by touching people. And everybody around us was saying, oh, you're just being cavalier. This is really not what you should be doing, and you're giving the wrong message. And our response always was, we're giving the right message. So we were dealing with a lot of hysteria and misinformation and just outright discrimination, I think, very early on.
Cliff, are there other reasons you wanted to start a separate unit for AIDS patients?
Yes. Almost from the beginning, there had been discussion about we need to separate, we need to put these patients somewhere else. And it was clear to me that it was for all the wrong reasons. And it was only later when we had more and more patients And it became clear to me that there was no way that we could keep up with coordinating the care, you know, on the general units. And so I went to the then director of nursing and said, I think we can rethink this, but let's do it for the right reasons.
What are some things you wanted to do different in terms of how the patients were treated compared to how they were being treated in the general hospital?
I just didn't like the approach. I didn't like where we were going. You know, I've always been a person that likes touching people. I think it's one of the reasons I went into healthcare and became a nurse. And I wanted a situation where we could touch, embrace, be a part of. I was really looking more, you know, at the time in nursing, we had this approach which was called primary nursing. And it was like an all-RN staff that would be able to coordinate and provide care. One nurse would be responsible for coordinating the entire care and working with the medical team so that you didn't have all these different people coming in and dealing with the different aspects of care. And that was really what I wanted to do and focus on. We also noticed right away, and it was very hard for me because I had a lot of friends already that I was seeing coming in with this, that we needed to really look at issues around family and visitation because healthcare was very rigid and was really stuck on this whole idea that it could only be visiting hours, that it could only be immediate family. And most of our patients didn't have family around.
Some of your patients, their family didn't even want to associate with them.
That's right. They didn't. We almost immediately began thinking about and talking about in all of these regular meetings and sessions that we had that maybe we needed to start letting our patients tell us who their family was and that we needed to kind of move away from this whole idea of traditional family and biological family. One of the early pieces in the film, Allison Moed is talking about the two guys that she was working with.
And she's one of the nurses
on the unit. Yes. Allison Moed was one of the nurses on the unit, and she was talking about how they set up the room like their home. And she used the example, they brought in champagne glasses and drank water out of them. I remember they brought in paintings and rugs and
bedspreads.
And, yep. You know, and I remember walking into that room and I was like, wow, this is how it should be. Yes, he was very sick, but what it did more than anything else was I think it allayed some anxiety, but it also made them more comfortable. And when you walked in, you just didn't feel that sterile institutional feel that hospitals have. But all of that was things that hadn't been done up until that point.
The film shows how a lot of medical workers early on were basically wearing spacesuits just to go into the room of a patient with AIDS to prevent contamination. And what were the rules that you wanted your doctors and your nurses to follow? And I'll ask you both this. When you and were they were dealing with AIDS patients early in the epidemic, when you still didn't even know how the virus was spread, perhaps it could have been spread, you know, through the air, like you didn't know, through a cough or a sneeze, you didn't know yet.
Well, at first we didn't even know there was a virus. So I always felt that it was good and very positive to touch patients. Cliff and I totally agree with that. I think it helped make the point, you know, we were being photoed a lot and filmed a lot because the media was all over this story. And I thought it was important that we did show that you could touch, you could hug patients without being afraid. There obviously did come a time when, for me, it was at the end of 1982 when it became obvious, I think, that this disease was being caused by a virus and that we didn't know the virus, we didn't know how it was spread. But I don't think there was ever a fear that it was easily spread because we'd seen so many patients by then. And those of us without other risk factors were still healthy. So there was fear for sure, but it was never really a fear of kind of getting this from the air.
In the movie, you talk about how early in the epidemic, before you really understood how the virus was spread, you and your wife were starting to have children, and she worked at the hospital too, and she treated AIDS patients too. She's a doctor. And I think you had two children in the mid-80s, yeah, early in the epidemic, and you were terrified that you would somehow infect them. Can you talk with us about that?
Well, Molly Cook is my wife, and was a physician at the hospital as well. She worked actually very closely with Merle Sandy and had seen AIDS patients before I did, in retrospect. And again, at the end of 1982, we'd seen a lot of patients, we'd seen a lot of death, and we knew how horrible this disease was, and we'd learned from a baby that was transfused at birth who died of AIDS quickly that this must be a virus. Viruses are really the only thing that's transmitted by blood transfusions. And so we knew that we were dealing with an infectious disease, and I was really terrified. And Molly was too, and we've got a good relationship. We can talk about things, and we never talked about it, but we never talked about our fear. It was just too fearful. And our oldest son was born just 2 weeks before I saw my first patient. My second son was born in 1984. Our daughter was born in 1987. So all through those years, and until we had the blood test for the virus, my nightmare was that I had given it to my kids. I didn't think about how that could have happened, and I didn't have a nightmare that I had it, but that I had given it to my kids. So there was a lot of fear that we really couldn't talk about easily.
Cliff, let me ask you this. Most of the people early in the epidemic who had AIDS were homosexual men. And this was an era when, being gay was really villainized in the U.S. Politicians, in some ways, things haven't changed. But, a lot has, some things haven't. But politicians, evangelical leaders were so anti-gay. And so how do you think the homophobia combined with the fear of the epidemic to produce an especially kind of combustible, paranoid view of both gay people and people with AIDS?
That was, I think, probably the most glaring reality of the situation. There was, even in San Francisco, which was, even at that time, was considered the gay Mecca. Gay people had very established careers and homes and families, and yet all of that started coming apart, and it really was centered around homophobia. There were people in the hospital that should have known better. If you saw the film, you saw that the situation where there was a group of nurses that basically said that what we were doing was crazy and that we were putting all of them at risk, and it went before the labor board. But that was all homophobia. That's what that was about.
I had a patient who was in a loving relationship. If it was today, they would have been married, but they were together. They had been together for years. And when my patient got sicker and sicker and died, suddenly, for the first time, his parents descended on the hospital. They took his body and took it to the East Bay and wouldn't tell his partner where he'd been buried. And that's, that wasn't AIDS, that was homophobia that just distorted things so badly.
Early in the epidemic, before you knew much about what it was, but you'd seen a lot of patients, both of you, you'd seen a lot of patients who had AIDS and who had died of AIDS. When new people came in, did they know that at that point in the epidemic, AIDS was basically a death sentence? Had they seen it around them? Did they already know? Or did you have to either tell them or hide from them the truth of what their future was going to be?
Well, I saw a lot of patients in those days, and to a person, they would say, I know that the odds are bad, but I'm going to beat this, and over and over, and it's just impossible to appreciate that HIV, if it's untreated, kills essentially 100% of the people. It's much worse than Ebola, much worse than smallpox. So everyone died. Every patient that was sick enough to come to look for medical care would die from this disease. It was, and people knew that. there was a lot of education to be done, but they knew that this was a really bad situation.
And we were always, you know, right up front with, you know, this is the odds, this is what you're dealing with, this is the situation. And for a lot of them, they kind of came around to realizing that they were in a terminal state. And some of the things that I personally learned out of this was how to be with people at the end of their lives. And, you know, as terrible as that can sound, I'm able now at this point in my life to look back and put it in perspective and realize that I had some really wonderful experiences with people in their passing, and they taught me a great deal, and it showed me, it really put in perspective the fact that life is on a continuum, and death is just part of that continuum. And I saw people have beautiful deaths, and, you know, and that was wonderful. It hurt. I cried. I went through all of that. But it was the people that fought and struggled right up to the end and wouldn't let go. In the film, you see staff and families say, it's okay,
let go.
I don't know how many times we said those things.
Dr. Volberding, you mentioned that you were watching young people die in large numbers, which is very uncommon unless you're talking about war. But you were both young.
These patients were our age.
Exactly.
I was 31 when I saw my first patient, and their parents were my parents' age. Mm-hmm. So the sense of kind of being together in this was something that was really a striking part of this early epidemic.
And Cliff, for you as a gay man, and since gay men were so at risk, you were living with the epidemic at work. But your community of friends was probably living with the epidemic too, so like there was no, there was no safe place where you could like get away.
You're right. There was no escaping it. We had to learn to deal with it.
You say in the movie that you don't have friends your age because they all died.
You know, that's true. I mean, it wasn't completely exclusive, but for sure, most of my friends, you know, died that were my age. And I mean, I look around me today, and when we did the premiere of this film at the Castro in November, I took with me my two best friends who were 20 years younger than me. And, you know, I can jokingly now say, well, the advantage is that now that I'm older, I have friends that are 20 years younger and they can take care of me. But that is also the reality, is that there are very few of my peers, contemporaries from that period that are with us today.
One of my early physicians that I hired was John Stanzel, a gay man came from Washington, D.C., and he said that he had lost his entire circle of friends to this disease. So the loss, I'm surprised there's not more PTSD in the community. I don't see real evidence of it, but there was so much loss.
Well, I should say here, In the world of AIDS, President Ronald Reagan is famous for not having mentioned the epidemic, which was killing thousands and thousands of people, not having mentioned it until 1987.
87, right.
6 years after the epidemic started. And then he created an AIDS commission to advise him on AIDS. I think it's fair to say you were concerned that there were no AIDS specialists or AIDS researchers, doctors or nurses dealing with AIDS who were represented on the commission.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I mean, and there were, you know, people from the military background and the rest. So there was a striking lack of people that were really actually working with this epidemic.
Dr. Volberding, you've done research on retroviruses and on developing antiretroviral drugs. What would you say is the state of the art now in terms of what's medically available, like, you know, medicines that are available for treatment and for prevention?
Sure, it's a stunning story, you know, and going back to the days when we barely knew that it was an infection and watching all of our patients die. In 1987, we began to have some drugs that were doing something. AZT, although it was controversial and didn't do much, was the first of the drugs. And then by 1996, the so-called triple therapy was developed, and that was really a turning point in the epidemic. We could suddenly start seeing some of our patients actually get better, not just die more slowly, but actually get better. And some of those people are still alive today. The effort since 96 has been to take those potent drugs and make them less toxic and more convenient. Today, we treat this very typically with what we call single-tab regimens, one pill taken once a day that contains two, three, or even four drugs, all in the same pill. And so many of my patients don't have any side effects at all from the medicines they're taking. So the change from the early days and seeing the drugs being developed and now seeing that this is truly a chronic condition is, I think it's one of the most amazing stories we'll ever hear from in medicine.
Cliff, you started the special unit for patients with AIDS at San Francisco General Hospital in 1983. What year was that unit shut down and why?
The unit stayed open, I think, until 2003.
That's what the movie said.
And I wasn't sure. So it stayed open, actually, a lot longer than I thought. I had gone back. I was in and out of there quite a bit. And I remember I'd gone back at some point for some meeting or something and was surprised. I was like, wow, it's still here. And I remember going up on the unit and the head nurse telling me that, well, only a few people here are people actually with HIV or AIDS. And it was mostly oncology. So it transitioned to oncology. And then I think the unit just essentially closed just a few years before they built the new hospital, which was one of the reasons we were able to use that old space in the film.
It closed because we didn't need it anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the treatments were working.
Paul Volberding, Cliff Morrison, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you so much for the work you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Volberding and Nurse Cliff Morrison are featured in the new documentary 5B. It's playing in select theaters and will be available on demand and for streaming later this year. The new movie, Yesterday, imagines a parallel reality where the Beatles and their music are suddenly erased from memory, with the exception of one aspiring singer-songwriter played by Himesh Patel. The film is directed by Danny Boyle, from a script by Richard Curtis, with a cast featuring Lily James, Kate McKinnon, and the musician Ed Sheeran. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
I'll say this much for the breezy but dispiriting musical romance, Yesterday. It has a clever conceit that it doesn't make the mistake of trying to explain. What explanation could there be for how the Beatles suddenly vanished from history, leaving behind only one lonely fan who remembers some of the greatest rock and roll songs ever written? Like a lot of surreal comic fantasies, the movie just invites you to shrug and go along with its cheerfully ridiculous premise. I was glad to do so, up to a point. The lead actor, Himesh Patel, best known for the British soap opera EastEnders, has an engaging presence and a lovely singing voice. There are worse ways to pass 2 hours than listening to Patel warble more than a dozen of the Beatles' biggest hits, even if he's no match for John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But the movie is directed with uncharacteristic blandness by Danny Boyle, who brought so much more dynamism to movies like Slumdog Millionaire and Steve Jobs. And the screenwriter Richard Curtis, the one-man British whimsy factory behind Love Actually and Notting Hill, seems less interested in exploring the Beatles' cultural legacy than in trapping his characters in another one of his patented rom-com formulas. Patel plays Jack Malik, a young man from the English county of Suffolk, who's about to give up on his dreams of a music career, despite the encouragement of his best friend and part-time manager, Ellie, played by Lily James. While riding his bike home one night, Jack gets hit by a bus and knocked unconscious right at the moment of an inexplicable worldwide power outage. He makes a speedy recovery, but the world around him has irrevocably changed. Jack realizes this when he's playing his guitar for Ellie and some other friends. He decides to perform the Beatles' 1965 hit Yesterday, and the others are awestruck by what they assume is his own composition.
Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
After running several frantic Google searches, Jack confirms that the impossible has happened. Somehow the Beatles never became the Beatles, and immortal songs like Let It Be, I Wanna Hold Your Hand, and Hey Jude were never written. Until now, of course. After frantically scribbling down all the lyrics he can remember, Jack begins performing the Beatles songs, passing them off as his own. His appearance on a local TV program captures the attention of none other than Ed Sheeran, who gives a sharp, self-effacing performance as himself. Sheeran is floored by this newcomer's obvious talent and makes him his opening act, which is all Jack Malik needs to become an overnight sensation. Jack's meteoric rise is meant to tell us something, namely that the appeal of the Beatles' music is so universal that it can captivate anyone, anytime, and anywhere. That's easy enough to believe, but Yesterday handles the music so clumsily that it almost gives you reason for doubt. Patel sings beautifully. He does an especially stirring rendition of In My Life. But the movie chops most of the songs up into fragments and litters them almost interchangeably throughout the story. It so takes our affection for the Beatles for granted that it never bothers to give the music a proper showcase. It doesn't let those songs soar and seduce us anew. In reducing the Beatles' catalog to a greatest hits cover album, Yesterday disregards some of the more intriguing possibilities of its goofy premise. What would the state of contemporary popular music even begin to look like if one of its greatest, most influential pillars had been removed? Because they're making a lightweight pop confection, the filmmakers don't expect you to trouble yourself with such concerns. But the questions they force us to dwell on are so much more banal by comparison. Will Jack and Ellie end up together in the end? Can world-famous celebrities ever be compatible with the working-class nobodies they fall in love with? It was a compelling enough dilemma in Notting Hill, but by now the Richard Curtis template is starting to wear awfully thin. Kate McKinnon does give the movie a welcome blast of comic energy as Deborah, a witheringly cynical music agent who takes Jack on as her latest client. Art is simply product to Deborah. Again and again, she tells Jack he's going to be rich beyond his wildest dreams. So long as the money keeps rolling in, she couldn't care less about what the Beatles songs mean or where they came from. She sums up this movie's worldview all too perfectly.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new movie Yesterday. Coming up, we talk with comic and actor Rami Youssef. He co-created and stars in the semi-autobiographical Hulu series Rami about being an observant Muslim, well, mostly observant, and the son of Egyptian immigrants. He has a new HBO stand-up comedy special called Feelings. This is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest Rami Youssef is a stand-up comic who often surprises people when he tells them he believes in God, or as he puts it, God, not yoga. His parents are immigrants from Egypt. His comedy is often about how he became an observant Muslim and how he also knowingly breaks some of the rules, like rules about dating and premarital sex. He co-created, co-writes, and stars in a semi-autobiographical Hulu comedy series in which he plays a character who not only shares the same first name, Rami, he shares the same dilemmas about family, girlfriends, and religion. Here's a scene in which Rami's mother is trying to convince him to settle down and marry. She suggests that when he goes to the mosque, he should look for a nice girl there to date. Here's how he responds.
I'm not going to flirt with girls at the mosque.
Why not? The girls in there are high quality.
The mosque is for praying. It's not for picking people up. And it's like a bunch of families, too, and you can't just walk up to a Muslim girl and, like, start spitting game or something. Like, what am I supposed to say? Like, hey, can I get your father's number?
Yes, why not?
I gotta go. I'm gonna be late.
Ya Allah. Rami, do you want to stay alone forever?
No, Mom, I don't. Just because I'm not with someone doesn't mean I'm gonna be alone forever, okay? I'm just figuring it out, okay?
Some of the same issues Rami Youssef deals with in his series, he deals with in a more first-person way in his stand-up comedy. He has a new HBO comedy special called Feelings. Here's an excerpt in which he's talking about his father. It's going to take a surprising turn.
My dad is an amazing human being. He just a hard worker. Just that thing you think about, like just anyone who comes to this country, that's my dad. Can do anything. Not just at work, comes home, he can cook, he can clean, fix the toilet, fix the car. He learned all these jobs just so he'd never have to pay another man. Like, his nightmare would be to hand cash to another man and look him in the eye. And he started working as a busboy. And in 10 years, he became the manager of a hotel. And that hotel was in New York City and was owned by Donald Trump. So I grew up with this photo in my living room of my dad and Donald Trump shaking hands. I saw it every day as a kid. And when you're a young Arab kid, anyone who's friends with your dad, like, that's your uncle. And last couple years, I'm watching TV, and I'm just like, Uncle Donald? Really?
Rami Youssef, welcome to Fresh Air. That really surprised me, that little twist. Is your father still working at a Trump hotel in New York?
No, he's not. But yeah, that is a true story.
So how do you make sense of your father's success at a Donald Trump hotel in New York and Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric and actions? Because as you say, Trump builds his business off immigrants, people like your father. So how do you make sense of that? How do you reconcile that?
You don't make sense of it. I don't think that there's a lot that adds up with a lot of the things that are going on. And I think that's part of the absurdity of it. I mean, I don't really find Trump to necessarily be something that's easy to joke about because it's pretty surreal to begin with. But I think laying out certain facts and kind of looking at something like, you know, in how it's tied not only to my family, but many families, right? I think families like mine are in many ways the bedrock of, you know, most business in a lot of places in this country, but obviously very specifically to his story and to where he's at.
Is the picture of your father and Donald Trump still on the wall?
My dad hid it from me because he didn't want me to use it in anything. he sometimes won't tell me things either. He'll just be like, look, I'm not trying to be part of the stand-up routine, all right? So you just go about your day, and then we hug, and he tells me he loves me, and then he moves on with his day.
So your parents came here as immigrants from Egypt. When did they come?
They came at different points in the 80s. They actually met in New York, which is kind of my favorite thing because they probably, you know, grew up very close to each other, maybe within 20 minutes, and then travel across the world to, you know, meet someone not far from home. and it really kind of encapsulates, I think, a lot of what immigrants go through, which is, you know, you put yourself in a situation where you really take a big leap of faith, and then you, you know, try to kind of find comfort and recreate what you know.
I'm sure when your parents came here, they had dreams for their children. Probably those dreams did not include you becoming a stand-up comic and having a series where you talk about your life, your family, and being Muslim in America, and you talk about sex.
Yeah.
So what was their reaction when they saw the direction you were heading in?
Well, you know, I try to show my parents anything that I'm about to do, probably anywhere from like 48 to 72 hours before it comes out to the public. I try to keep it as under wraps as possible, really just to give them the opportunity to say to their friends and the rest of the family, you know, they can very honestly be like, look, he wouldn't let us see any of it. He wouldn't tell us what it was. We had no idea this was happening. I like to give them the ability to say that honestly, because I don't want them to have to deal with the anxiety of it. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety that comes when you're making something, especially for, you know, a lot of my work works to, you know, talk about my background, which is being an Arab Muslim. In terms of positive media, there's not really a lot. In terms of nuanced, there's even less. So there is this weight that kind of sits on something that comes from someone like me, and there's an anxiety that comes with that.
You know, you say, I think it's in the stand-up special, you say that sex was a subject that was never discussed in the family. But of course, you know, you have relationships in your series, Rami, and you talk about, you know, some aspects of your sex life in your stand-up. I want to play a scene that starts off being about sex and ends up going in a completely different direction. So this is a scene from the first episode. You've had sex with a woman you're dating then. And afterwards, you're checking your condom to see if there were any leaks. And she walks in on you as you're checking for leaks.
I was just checking if there was any holes in it, you know?
Like, why would there be a hole?
You ever see the way they ship these things? It's like on a truck, there's like a bunch of dudes. They're like, who are those dudes? Like, I don't know them, you don't know, you know? So it's just to make sure that there isn't a faulty one.
And you do this like every time we have sex?
Yeah, I mean, it just takes a sec.
I don't know why, but I feel like kind of offended.
Chloe, look, this doesn't have to get weird, okay?
Oh, I'm making it weird?
No, there's nothing to worry about. It's just so that we don't have to worry.
Even if, like, something crazy happened, you know I'm on the pill, right? And if the pill didn't work, we'd do the responsible thing and, like, take care of it.
Yeah, but we can't just take care of it, right? I mean, we don't even really know what it is. I mean, look, I'm totally pro women getting to choose what to do with their bodies. I am. But I'm Muslim, so I'm just pro us not having to make that choice.
No, like, you're Muslim, I thought, in the way that I'm Jewish. Like, it's a cultural thing. I didn't know that you were Muslim.
Yeah.
You drink. Religious Muslims don't drink.
I actually don't drink.
The other night we were out of the bar and you bought the entire table drinks.
Yeah, but mine was a Coke.
Tonight I asked you, do you want another glass of wine? You're like, no, I'm at my limit.
Well, I was at my limit. My limit's just none, because I'm Muslim.
Oh, okay. So you get girls drunk and stay sober so you can sleep with them.
What?
That feels kind of date rapey.
That's not what I do. That's not date rapey. If anything, I'm taking alcohol out of the equation. I'm like a designated driver. I'm your, like a friend.
So why are you hiding everything from me?
Look, Chloe, it's just, I've met girls who seem open-minded and then they're not.
And you think that's me?
No, I know, I thought maybe you'd be into the idea of me being culturally different, but hate that I actually believe in God.
I don't care that you're Muslim. I care that you've been lying to me.
So that's a scene from the Hulu series Rami, which is co-written and created by my guest, Rami Youssef. So Rami, one of the things I find really interesting about that clip is that you're seeing both sides of this as the creator of the series. You're seeing your point of view, but you're also, I think, really interestingly portraying the woman's point of view. Like, that kind of sounds like date rape, that, you know, you're helping her get drunk and you're staying sober. And I'm wondering if you wrote that scene with women or a woman and kind of compared points of view on it.
At that time, we were making the pilot. We didn't have our writer's room, so it was me and Ari Kacher and Ryan Welch. And so we were going through my stand-up, and I have a bit about, you know, why I only wear condoms. I've, you know, never had sex without one, and it's because I don't want to be in the hypothetical place where I would have to make a choice, mostly because it's not my choice. So I would feel, you know, this kind of helplessness where you don't know where it sits spiritually, and there's all this confusion, and so the character sits in a lot of confusion. And so we took that joke and we kind of wanted to create the most dynamic way to talk about that. And so I think the whole point of this show, the whole point of stand-up to me, the design of it, is to interrogate my character. So we drafted it out. I sent it to women that I know, that I trust, and we talked through it. And then we cast Anna Conkle, who's a great actor, and I talked through it with her. And we kind of rewrote some of it on our feet just to make sure that it felt as, you know, fleshed out as something like that could. You know, I've never had someone walk in and have that type of conversation about it. I mean, I've had someone notice it, but then kind of not say something. But I really wanted to be as honest as we could.
So your character in your series has been trying to figure out what kind of Muslim he is. And I imagine you have gone through that yourself about where you fit in and what you're going to observe and what you're not going to observe within the religion. And I think so many people, no matter what their religion, go through that. So can you talk a little bit about what your process has been like and how difficult it is to feel like you're not completely all in? Do you know what I mean? Like you are a practicing Muslim. You probably practice it slightly different than your parents do, and you're not completely all in. I mean, it's clear, like, you have premarital sex, for example.
Yeah, we would call it the picking and choosing. Sometimes we would call it a la carte, where we're kind of, you know, everyone's got a different line, and it's really funny. There's the people who are like, okay, I'm going to have sex, but I'm not going to drink. Then there's the people who are like, no way am I having sex, but let's do acid on Saturday. And, you know, there's kind of these really, you know, everyone has a code, you know, and I think that transcends any specific culture or faith. We're constantly rationalizing where we stand and our own code, and dealing with, you know, how you can be the best version of yourself. And that's, I feel like since I was a kid, that was actually my only real goal that I ever felt. I always used to actually find it bizarre when people knew, you know, be that kid at 11 years old who's like, yeah, I'm going to be a rock star. And I would think that was insane, because I'd be like, well, how do you know? Like, you don't know enough about yourself. That's just a thing that, you know, you think is cool. But how is that authentic? We're only 11. You know, that would be my, that would be the way I looked at things. But what I did know from a really early age was I wanted to connect with my higher self and kind of be the best spiritual version of myself. And I never really felt like I had to be religious. Like, my parents showed it to me. And I remember my father telling me, I'm going to show it to you, and then you're going to make your choice. But I always knew what my choice was.
Why at age 11 were you thinking about being your higher self and wanting to connect to your faith? It's not what most 11-year-olds are thinking about.
I wish I had a good answer. I don't know. I mean, it was always on my mind. And then I think as I got older, you know, I do think that obviously being Muslim became politicized and villainized in such a way that I definitely went down really deep kind of rabbit holes about who I was and what it meant to be this thing that supposedly was, you know, the root of all evil in the way that it was framed, and kind of coming to understanding that it's not that at all. I mean, that was a big thing for me, and that was a big process for me to kind of work through. But I remember feeling it even before that, even before 9/11 and before, you know, this narrative really took hold. But then obviously as that narrative took hold, you become even more introspective too.
So when you started doing stand-up comedy, what did you talk about?
You know, in the beginning, I think I talked a lot about political things. That was interesting to me. And then as I kept moving, I realized that I wanted to talk about things that were more personal, and kind of realizing that the most effective thing to do would be to talk about the thing you don't want to talk about, which I feel like you hear a lot when it comes to art, but you don't really understand it until you're on stage saying things that you wouldn't say to your family, and you feel how it hits and how it connects because it's so unresolved within you.
Can you give us an example of that from your early years in comedy?
I was doing stand-up during Ramadan, and I was at a bar, and I broke my fast at the bar, just, you know, drinking a cup of water, and then I went up and did a set. And I had had this experience a couple nights earlier, and I just decided to talk about it on stage, which was that I was, you know, hooking up with this girl, and we, like, went out, and then she wanted to watch a movie, and then she was like, oh, let's go to this party, but I was trying to hook up with her before the sun would rise, and then it got really late, and it was, like, 3 a.m, and I was kind of trying to, like, make it happen, and then I just realized, you know, I just felt like a schizophrenic person. I was like, am I really trying to hook up with someone before the sun rises? This is insane, and I started talking about it on stage, and I just felt like I was talking about something I needed to talk about. And it really opened up for me, you know, that even though this thing felt so specific, right? I mean, think from a joke writing standpoint, it doesn't feel like it's anything that would resonate in any way because it feels so, I'm like, who else is doing this? But then I started talking about it and I realized just how much it did connect and how needed the conversation was, again, mainly for me, but it also felt that way with the audience too.
Rami Youssef, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with the comedy special.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Rami Youssef's new HBO comedy special is called Feelings. The first season of his series, Rami, is streaming on Hulu. Fresh Air Weekend was produced this week by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.